when creating with wood, each piece has its own characteristic due to the grain. Thus, even if the form is the same, the piece is always one of a kind. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice monthly program devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. This week, we once again present two artists who work with wood. We had interviewed each several years ago when they were having a local exhibit. Once again, they are both showing their work in the same place. This time, it's Solvang. More information on the Wildling Museum at the end of the program. This week's two artists are Roger Combs and Barry Lundgren. Both are from Atascadero, but what they create in wood is quite different. We begin with furniture designer Roger Combs.
Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque. We now take a quick jaunt over Cuesta Grade to the rolling hills of the North County. Good afternoon, Roger.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for coming up to my shop.
And Chrissa is here as well.
Howdy, folks.
And for those of you who don't know Roger or his works, that's unfortunate. He is an absolutely extraordinary woodworker that makes incredibly beautiful furniture. Our typical question to get you all warmed up, how did you get started in this?
Well, I was a biology major.
I was too.
Yeah, I lasted a year and then I switched to industrial arts. At that time, I started doing very simple woodcraft with grape trays. I would take fruit box labels and decoupage on grape trays. And I did the Cal Poly Christmas craft shows, I did the Poly Royal shows, and it helped put me through school. That's how I got started, but it's definitely evolved.
It certainly has. So you're originally from the Central Valley?
Yeah. I moved from Fresno when I was 20. I moved from Fresno to Shell Beach. It was culture shock the right way. I loved it. I was in Shell Beach for a year and a half and then San Luis for a year after that. I loved going to Cal Poly, and that's where I met Chrissa.
Did you have a class that was in that room and therefore met Richard Harrison?
That's how I met Richard. Poly had a great crafts program at that time. I was in an industrial arts major in the IT department. It was a great time.
And my reference to Richard Harrison was he was the tech who was also a superb woodworker, furniture maker, so was an influence on several of us.
I thank you for that memory jog, because I remember he made the most incredible rockers that were just phenomenal.
It certainly had an element of Sam Maloof inspiration
right.
to them.
Yeah, right.
It's funny, I got a call from a gentleman named Ralph Lee when I first started apprenticing with Richard, which was in 1982, after I'd graduated from Cal Poly. Ralph Lee called me this last week and inquiring about Richard. He had lost track and Richard passed away. When I first started helping Richard, that was the first chair I was involved in. He was an architectural illustrator, Ralph Lee was, and I had made a rack for his 200 different felt pens, and he still uses it. So, and Richard had put me in that direction as a side job. Working and apprenticing with Richard was a very magical time. He definitely influenced me a lot. Just little things. That sanding is, you know, actually cutting and shaping and taking raw lumber and cutting the ends off first till you get to sound wood. It's a lot of little things that I use every day.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your furniture, the stools, there's that incredible buffet dresser thing that is stunning.
Thanks, Stephen. Thank
and the sofa table, which is my personal favorite.
So. Mine too. Mine too.
So how do you get your inspirations? I mean, do you work in series?
I do. I do limited production of a number of different designs. And I have for a number of years. My stools, I've made at least 400 of them over the years. And I still love making them. The entry tables, I've been making for about 20 years. They have evolved, but they definitely have that style of mine mm-hmm. that I've been doing for a while.
What do you think keeps the love going?
It's the wood. The wood's always different. It may be a repeat performance of a piece, be it a stool, table, dining table, bench, whatever, but the wood is always different.
What are your favorite woods to work with?
I like contrast, first of all. So I love maple. I love African woods of Wenge, zebra wood, Bubinga. And then domestic woods, I like cherry and cedar. But I tend to those contrasting woods, the African woods and maple, I gravitate toward, especially figured maple.
It's really striking when you get that graphic combination of the extremely dark and then the very, very pale woods.
And I love the finishes that the maple in those woods take. I spend a lot of time sanding, shaping, and then the actual finishing process, which is usually a hand-rubbed oil finish. It's a 7-coat process. I love that first coat because it just pops, you know?
Yeah, it brings out the grain.
And oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah. And that the step right before that first coat of oil, too, is when a piece is finely sanded, shaped, it's ready. And there's a real beauty of that raw wood ready for finishing, too.
You've been referencing now sanding 2 or 3 times already in this conversation. Your first comment had to do with sanding definitely being a part of, I think you even used the word cutting, but shaping.
Correct.
Talk us through kind of what that sanding process is by any power equipment, by hand, by combination, and what it is that you really find yourself doing besides just making the wood feel smooth.
It's all of the above of power machinery and then hand sanding. I take pieces as far as I can with power equipment. I'm not 25 anymore, and they have their place. As far as the sanding process, it's not only tactile, but even more so is visual. The stools are an example. I want this scoop to be consistent and feel comfortable and mm-hmm. feel right. That's step one, to get it to there with the rough sanding. And then comes the fine sanding, so the grain really pops up. It's a matter of clarity in the finer grits. And then I save the details till the very end. Stools are a good example. These are sharp points. The edges I'm referencing, and those are the final things that I shape right before finishing.
That place of getting lost in what you do?
I got to think about that one for a minute. I do. I get real focused in the process of making a piece. It takes concentration because quite often it's a one-shot deal. You're bandsawing to a line, you have to pay attention. You're shaping to a feel, you have to pay attention. And I don't wear an iPod, you know, I stay real focused. I'll agree to do a piece for somebody, but whatever it takes to get it to where it's what I want, there are no compromises on that. Now, back up a little bit. Have I ever made a perfect piece? Probably not. But get close. I rented this shop from Corey and Steve Dudley. Steve passed away way too young. I learned a lot from working with Steve. What I learned from him is, you know, the no perfect piece. Not everything is evident in a piece. Mm-hmm. Is it cutting corners? No. But there's some things that you're not compromising. You're just moving on mm-hmm. through a piece. I think that's what I'm trying
to say. And
that
to us is what makes things unique, and the fact that you can tell that they're handmade is because they do not look like they're stamped out.
Yeah.
Your furniture has beautiful profiles. As you walk around them, and the profiles change and shift. Do you do that while you're working on the piece? Do you walk around it and check to make sure that everything is going the way you want it to be and to come out the way you want it to be?
I do, especially on new pieces or a different version of what I've done before. The buffet is an example. In the past, it's had a straight edge on the back to where it's designed to fit against a wall. This piece, I did a subtle arc on both edges with a finished back to where it could be used in the middle of a room. Mm. But in that process with the top, I rough shaped it, put it on the case, and got a visual on it and went from there. And it felt right and it looked right.
How long have you been doing this professionally?
I've been making a living at it for the last 20 years. But then even after college, I was doing construction, worked at a lumber company, ended up managing a lumber company. I always had a shop. I was always making something. And it's my passion. I love it.
It shows.
It shows.
Good.
Were you making things as a child?
Yeah. My dad was a farmer in the Central Valley. And as a farmer, he needed a weld. He was a welder. He did, you know, his own work on his equipment. But then I would make, you know, little cars and this and that and the other, just for fun. Good fun.
What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a desk, my latest commission. It's a version of a piece I've made before. What I'm showing you right now, this is going to be the top, the veneered top.
Veneer in this case being eighth inch about thick?
It's a little over an eighth of an inch, and then I will take it to a local shop, and he has a big wide belt sander that I will sand it down smooth both sides before I do my laminating in a vacuum press, where I learned at Cal Poly. I've owned a vacuum press for about 20 years now. So I make a core out of MDF. I band it with poplar or maple, and then run my veneers through the sander and the core and get them glue ready and do my laminating. So it's like I make my own plywood. Mm-hmm. Expensive plywood. On my wall, I have, this is just a little bit of the lumber that I keep in inventory. You can see these zebra wood sticks are approximately 12 foot long. I cut up a board this last week. It was about 14 inches wide, 12 foot long. And I turned that whole stick into veneer, which took me
some
good
time.
Part of the week.
Yeah.
And then as I'm sectioning that board, I'm thinking, okay, this section will be veneers for back. This will be veneers for drawer fronts. This will be veneers for top. The wood's very expensive, so that's part of the time, too, is taking the time to lay it out, what's going where.
That's chosen by grain pattern a lot? Or
Yes. This top is a good example. I don't get sapwood in zebra wood that often, especially sapwood with spalting in it, and I just love that for the top. I knew that section was going to be the top.
Let's talk about sapwood.
The sapwood is actually the outer part right below the bark. Walnut, it's white. Zebra wood, it's whiter. It's typically lighter in color. That's the way trees go. I like that contrast. It's still the same wood, but I love that contrast of the sapwood.
And cutting these veneer sheets is done on the bandsaw?
It's a combination of table saw and bandsaw. Hopefully it will be only bandsaw in this next year. That's my next equipment purchase, is a really nice resaw bandsaw that I can generate my veneers easier. I like simple shapes. I do. You see that in a lot of my work. I like the harmony of a combination of simple shapes that are finely crafted.
Well, thank you, Roger. This has been incredibly entertaining and also enlightening.
Thanks so much for coming up to my shop and visiting with me about my craft.
You're most welcome, and it's certainly our pleasure.
Roger's website is rogercombs.com.
You are listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. We have just been talking with Roger Combs, a woodworker artist from Atascadero. Next up, wood turner Barry Lundgren, also from Atascadero.
The sound of a chainsaw is the sound of a potential source for materials. We visit Barry Lundgren's studio in the hills of Atascadero. Barry is known for his ability of transforming ordinary logs into delicately turned bowls, vases, and lidded jars.
Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you guys today?
We're doing okay.
This is all about turning wood.
That's definitely my passion and kind of what I'm known for.
And how long have you been doing it?
Probably 14, 15 years now. I've been in the wood for probably 20, and making furniture and just picture frames, that kind of stuff. But wood turning is definitely what I like to do the best as far as working with wood.
And how did that change happen?
I actually saw a wood turner named John Jordan do just a demonstration at a wood turning like expo where you buy tools and trade show kind of thing, and watch them just turn a natural edge bowl. And it was just, for me, amazing to see the shavings flying. And then went home and tried it and wasn't real successful, but just the experience just set off just something that became really addicting, and it's just evolved from there.
We keep getting terminology that we like to help people understand. So natural edge bowl.
Natural edge bowl is basically taking a log, cutting it in half, band sawing a circle out of that half log, remounting it on the lathe. It just follows the circumference of the log, and you end up getting two high spots and two low spots naturally. It's really hard to explain, so you have to show it. And then once you show them from half a log cut, band sawed into a round, mounted on a lathe, the third process is the finished product. And then they finally, the little light bulb goes off, and they get it.
You've enjoyed that process, obviously, and you do some of what we might call more conventional or straight edge bowls as well.
Yeah.
So you do them both.
Yeah, I do them both. I'll even leave the whole log mounted in a rectangle and turn a bowl out of a rectangle, which some people have a hard time figuring that one out too. And they're actually pretty scary, and it does take a little more knowledge. That's more of an advanced kind of project kind of thing, but you know, they're pretty interesting too.
Obviously, the more even that exterior surface is, the safer it is?
Definitely, definitely. When you first mount a piece, a lot of times they're out of balance and not around. And I've mounted some large pieces on the lathe and had the lathe kind of walk across the shop until you kind of get them round. So it can be a really scary thing. For me, a lot of times I'll leave the tailstock up as a safety precaution and just until I'm almost finished with the piece, especially on those square edge pieces, to where it's kind of vague what you're actually seeing, what you're turning. And then big pieces too. You know, you can't spin big pieces very fast, because if it goes flying, they'll take you out. There's a ratio there that you shouldn't exceed, and then you're ending up being not safe.
Yeah, I don't think most people realize how dangerous some of these artistic expressions can be.
But as you get a piece more round from out around, you can add more speed.
And the advantage of having it a little faster?
The lathe makes cutting easier. As it's spinning faster, the tool's taking off more wood. So, you know, smaller pieces, you can spin them really fast, you know, and bigger pieces, you just spin them faster again as they get rounder and rounder. If you had a void in the piece of wood, and that's the common balance of turning pieces that have voids in them. People are like, how did you do that? It's got this big hole in it. Well, you actually spin them a little faster because the tool is always touching something. You know, if you slow them down, that's when you can actually get a grab and yank the whole thing off the lathe. So it's a fine line, and you learn that with experience, and you do have some accidents.
Where's the wood come from for you?
Boy, it comes from everywhere. People know that I'm a wood turner now, and they'll have a tree fall down. That's the neat thing about it. I turn a lot of local woods. You know, I do buy some online. Some come from Australia. Some come from around the world, and had a really neat commission job this winter, January, February. A lady down in Santa Barbara had a red oak tree fall down that her kids grew up with, and it was like their family tree. It was a beautiful tree, had some beautiful figure in it, and I'm like, well, I rough turned her two big bowls out of it. I got to get these really thin or they're going to crack, and she's not going to want them. So I ended up turning them really thin and left the bark edge on them, and it was a really old tree, so the bark was like 3 or 4 inches thick, some of the thickest oak bark I've ever seen. It was an old, old tree. The bark warped to the outside, stayed on because it was wet and fresh, and I got them thin and they didn't crack. It was a really neat project, and now I'm looking for oak all the time.
If you're not turning oak, have you got another favorite?
Walnut. I get a lot of local walnut, and again, people cut it up for firewood, and as a wood turner or even a wood worker, a furniture maker, some of the woods that end up in people's fireplaces makes you want to cry. But basically, I make salad bowls out of them. But some of the can get really figured, and then you can make vases or urns or whatever out of them. But it's one of my favorite woods. It smells really good, and that's the thing people don't appreciate in wood, is the smell of woods, especially when you get them fresh. Every wood's got a different scent. A friend gave me camphor, and it's a really pretty wood, and I took two cuts and just threw it in a firewood pile, ran me right out of the shop. It was just too much. It was just too over-fragrant, kind of.
I remember being in Denmark and taking a walk one day, and it had rained, I think, the day before. And all of a sudden, I'm going, what is that? I know that smell. And, of course, it was a pile of teak. Oh, and then, of course, I sat and drooled looking through the fence.
Have you ever used almond wood?
Yes, almond's a really nice wood, really pretty wood. Has some orange to reddish characteristics with a really nice light sapwood, which is a really nice contrast. But most of the fruit woods are really unstable. That's just a characteristic. So you got to get it and like turn it fresh. And I've turned pieces that were just cut the day before and still had some of the natural edge bowls that I turned cracked. So I try not to use stuff like that. I try to use materials that I know that are going to be stable. Madrone burl is one of my favorite woods, because it gets this really neat texture to it. It just warps and distorts, and you'll turn a perfectly symmetrical bowl, and within a day, it's already gone just crazy on you and gets this really unique texture. And you incorporate it in your shapes, and you just kind of let it do that, you know?
Okay, you've been mentioning wood being wet or dry, so I have this favorite tree that I grew up with, and somehow it's either fallen down or has to be taken out, and I'm thinking that, boy, you'll be the recipient of it.
Great.
What would be the method that you would want it delivered to you in?
As a wood turner, the best wood is in the trunk because it's the straightest. The best is in the wet form, to where you're going to end seal them, and there's a wax sealer. Anchor Seal is one of the brands, and it's just a waxy emulsion that you paint on the end grain, and it'll keep it in the round. And again, something like that would rough turn it, let it sit, depending on the size of the piece, for 3 to 6 months. And some of the exotic woods, some of the ebonies and stuff like that, that you let sit for over a year. And then they finally stabilize. Sometimes it takes, again, some of those exotic woods that long to kind of stabilize before you can go back and finish them, especially if you're going to put a lid on them. Lidded containers are really a whole process in itself. Sometimes it'll take me 3 or 4 times of turning it in different stages of wetness to get it to dry, and I'll turn it again just before I get that final fit on the lid to get the fit just right.
Wood is still alive after the tree is cut down. It's just expanding, contracting, cracking, warping, doing a lot of what it wants to do. How do you know when it stopped moving, or how do you hope you know when it stopped moving?
That is what they call with experience, and there's a giant learning curve, and everybody's got their own kind of different philosophy on that. I love to rough turn wood. I'd rather just make shavings than have to finish them, and I've got 100 bowls in the shed there. The shed is insulated, so it's always nice and cool, and that's what you want to do with them. In the summertime when it's hot here, I'll actually leave a 4 to 5 foot pile of shavings behind the lathe, and then I'll stuff them in there right after I rough turn them, and they'll slowly dry as the shavings are drying in the shop, and then I'll move them to the bottom floor in my storage shed, and then I write the dates on them. And then, you know, I've had people that want salad bowls, and I'll leave them in the rough form, and I'll just go, hey, pick one out, and then I'll finish it. And it usually just takes a day to finish one. There's all different stages, again, depending on what you do with the piece. I do turn pieces wet and let them warp and distort, and they're done. And they'll be moving a month after I've sold a piece or after I've finished turned it. And, you know, it's just kind of part of the fun of the process. But, you know, a symmetrical piece like a salad bowl or something, it usually takes 3 to 6 months to dry. You know, summertime a little faster around here.
So we talked a little bit about how you started turning. How did you start creating? Do you remember, just in terms of when you got interested in making things?
Yeah, really, boy, I was probably 7 or 8. Our family got an older brother, and my folks would pack up the car and take us camping. I've always been an outdoor person and got into photography. I had a little point-and-shoot, I think, Kodak back then, and we'd go to Yosemite or Emerald Bay and Tahoe and go camping, and I was always into taking pictures. And represented our high school in some local competitions, you know, in the LA school district, and was just really into photography. Had an art scholarship right out of high school to the Academy of Arts up in San Francisco, but didn't really like San Francisco. And I went to Brooks for a semester and wanted to be an underwater photographer. That's what I wanted to do when I grew up. And didn't really work out. Became a fisherman and a diver right after Brooks. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history. No regrets. I love fishing. I love diving. That's my job now. I dive for sea urchins. And that's the best job for me I could have ever had. Wood turning is an immediate thing where furniture, God, might take you a month to make a commissioned piece for somebody, you know, and your spare time. So there's something about the shavings flying too that all wood turners would tell you that's why they do it. You're kind of destroying something, yeah, but you're making something all at the same time. So it's just a fun process.
Now we go back to the other secrets. How are you hollowing something out that has about a 2-inch opening at the top?
They actually call them hollow turning tools, and you turn your shape and then you hold it with the bottom and you drill to your depth with a regular drill.
Okay.
And then you come in with a straight cutter and you just start working the opening a little bit, and you just start opening it up down the drill length, and you open the piece up, keep taking more. You got to blow the shavings out of it. And then once you get it close enough to the wall, there's a cutter on an angle that works the wall thickness, and then you have calipers and you can judge your size. And it's definitely a more advanced technique. It's something that a beginning wood turner is not going to tackle right away. You do so many of them, you just kind of get the hang of it.
And the finishing of this, are you sanding it while it's on the lathe?
Yeah, you sand them on the lathe. So, you know, if you cut the piece cleanly, you can start with like 120. If you got a little bit of tear, you're going to start with some 80 grit. And I work them up to 400 grit with a soft pad, and then I'll go to 600-800 and all the way to micro mesh, sometimes to 2400, and they're super smooth.
Oh, I'm just admiring the wood grains and all these different things. And as you said, the natural edge bowls and how they have warped to these different shapes, and they're just incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, that oak piece is warped just extremely, because it had a branch coming on almost out of the bottom, so it almost folded the piece over, and then it stretched out oval like oak does, and then again the bark rims flared out, and I actually have found that through turning so many of these oak pieces here lately in the last year that I actually incorporated that bend into the shape, mm-hmm, and it really flares the pieces out real nicely.
Just as much science as there is art in all of this. It's knowing your materials and how they react. And
well, Barry, this is really impressive work. I have loved your wood turning for years. Glad that I own a couple.
Thank you very much. And again, it's kind of what drives me, keeps me going. And it's just a passion, and it's just fun. And it's why you wake up in the morning to find something to do.
We have been talking with two artists who work with wood. Furniture maker Roger Combs and wood turner Barry Lundgren. They are both a part of an exhibit at the Wildling Museum in Solvang up through February 13th. These two joined several others from this area as part of this exhibit. They are all part of the Santa Ynez Woodworking Guild, the sponsoring organization for the show. To complement the wood pieces, there is also a display of photography by David Paul Bales, entitled Trees in Transition. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. I am Krissa Hewitt, and with co-host Stephen DeLuque, we produce this twice-monthly program here at the station. We'll be back in February with another exploration of the visual arts. As always, thank you so much for listening.